Mr. Jones.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Joshua Jones on behalf of the defendant appellant in this matter, Frank Kyra. Mr. Kyra's appeal presents two issues for resolution by this Court. The first issue is whether the district court's ruling excluding the testimony of Mr. Kyra's attorney, Jeffrey Faywell, unless the defendant testified, put an impermissible burden on Mr. Kyra's right to remain silent. The second issue relates to the omission of, from the jury instructions, of the requisite mens rea for the offense, which was premeditation and malice aforethought.
So is there any way we can rule in your favor on the Fifth Amendment point without at the same time overruling United States against Palladino?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that this case is distinguishable from United States versus Palladino, and this is the reason why. This case, the district court made an explicit ruling that as a legal matter, Mr. Kyra's testimony was necessary before Mr. Faywell could testify to certain statements. In Palladino, what happened is the district court independently excluded evidence and said, these statements can't come in, and that was erroneous. And then the defendant...
That sounds like six of one and half a dozen of the other. District judge said, this evidence you propose is hearsay. The only way you can get evidence along these lines in is to testify. That would be direct non-hearsay testimony. And then there might be grounds for cross-examination or testing the credibility of the testimony. Perfectly ordinary ruling.
Your Honor, I think that it's distinguishable because in Palladino, there was not that explicit legal conclusion that the testimony was necessary before the admission.
That sounds like this is an easier case than Palladino, then.
Yes, I believe so.
For the government.
No,
an easier case
then
for the government than Palladino.
Then obviously I'm misunderstanding. Your Honor.
Look, it's perfectly normal. A district judge says X is hearsay. You can't get it in indirectly. You have to get it in from the person who has first-party knowledge. Right? And that person then testifies. It's not only Palladino, but its predecessors like Luce that say if the person testifies, you then can't complain. Well, Palladino is hardly some novel decision. It's based on two major decisions of the Supreme Court.
You know, those two decisions of the Supreme Court are the opposite of Palladino. In fact,
so are you drawing a distinction between erroneously admitting prejudicial evidence and erroneously excluding evidence? I'm not sure what distinction you are seeing between Palladino and Luce on the one hand and this case.
In this case, the defendant took the stand because the district court said, if you testify, this other evidence that you want to get in comes in. The evidence is different. The evidence coming from Mr. Kyra's attorney saying these statements were made is different from Mr. Kyra saying this happened. In this case, Mr. Kyra is taking the stand because the district court informed him that as a legal matter he needed to testify before somebody else could offer different information. In Palladino, what happened was the district court excluded evidence and the defendant himself got on the stand to offer that same evidence. In this case, we're talking about different evidence, independent evidence.
Why should that make a difference, given this problem about remedies under the Supreme Court's decisions in Palladino?
It should make a difference here. Well, I guess there's two things here. First, it should make a difference in this case because it's not the typical kind of decision where a defendant is just looking at the evidence and deciding, I need to testify because I want to get particular evidence. I want my testimony to be heard. In this case, the defendant is testifying because he thinks it's a legal matter. He needs to testify for other evidence to come in. But
he testifies on and on and on. This is such a small bit of his testimony. It's hard for me to see this as the one thing that caused him to forego his Fifth Amendment privilege. There's this one little exchange that's about this conversation. It's actually a little shocking to me because at the end of it, an exchange in which he's very clear that Jack's plan was to kill the prosecutor, and then there's a question following this first conversation with Mr. Faywell, did you call the police? No, I did not. But that's what it turns out to be. And it's hard for me to see how that's something that his decision hinges on.
Well, Your Honor, certainly his testimony is much more expansive than that.
It goes on forever, right.
That specific point. But if he takes the decision that, based on the circumstances of the case, if he were to take make the decision to take the stand, he's not going to be able to just get up and testify to some small portion of it. He's going to have to address the entirety of the government's evidence, and that's what happened in this case.
Mr. Jones, let me ask you, I guess, here's what worries me, okay? I'm worried that you're arguing for a rule that says if a defendant testifies, things turn out badly. The defendant can get a new trial by pointing to any evidentiary error the judge made before the defendant testified and say, that's what made the difference and made me take the stand. Are you arguing for that rule or something much narrower?
Mm-hmm. Arguing for something much narrower, because I think
how would you describe it?
If the district court makes the defendant's testimony a necessary precondition for other evidence, I think that brings the facts of the case closer to cases like...
Explicitly or implicitly?
In this case, explicitly.
Should it make a difference?
Yes. Because
so if the district judge doesn't say it but just makes a mistake that has the effect of causing the defendant to testify, there's no claim. There's no error.
Yes, I think the crucial distinguishing factor here is that the district court explicitly states this erroneous requirement that Mr. Kira needs to testify before other evidence comes
in. Why should that make a difference?
Because that provides the factual nexus that the court was worried about in the concerns that Your Honor is expressing, with that the defendant, it makes it less speculative that it's because of the district court's ruling that the defendant is testifying. Because there is that explicit, essentially explicit hook that the defendant or that the court is putting in.
I don't get it. The reason why he had to testify is because he is the declarant. The district court says this is hearsay. The declarant has to testify.
That's 801D.
The declarant happens to be the defendant. But why is it any different from if the district judge had said, in order to get in, you can't get hearsay in, you have to put the declarant on the stand. Right? That's what the district judge says. The declarant was your client. That's all.
There's no requirement. It's still here. If Mr. Kira were to take the stand and testify, I told somebody X, that statement's hearsay. Whether or not the declarant is on the stand is irrelevant to whether or not it's an out-of-court statement offered for the truth.
No, Mr. Kira on the stand is talking about what he said to Mr. Faywell. That's not hearsay. If he wants to say what Mr. Faywell said back, then we would have a different declarant. But to the extent he's saying, I said I got a text message from Jack, I said that this is what, you know, happened, that's not hearsay. Now, maybe the contents of the text message, I mean, we can kind of go down various paths, but it's the rule says if the declarant, it testifies, then you can bring in certain things.
Yeah. But I'm not supposed to ask that question. I would respectfully disagree. I
think you just don't understand the hearsay doctrine. Judge Wood has stated canonically the hearsay doctrine, and you say, I respectfully disagree. You know, we've got roughly 700-800 years of law plus the rules of evidence on the other side.
Your Honor, I will simply state that the mere fact that the declarant is on the stand does not make his out-of-court statement not hearsay.
But that's not what the federal rules of evidence say, actually. Yeah, it says the following things aren't hearsay. But anyway, that's...
Well, I agree with you, except when we're dealing with a party. But could I ask you to turn to the jury instruction issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
And specifically, is it correct that you approved the jury instructions in this case?
We didn't represent Mr. Kira at trial, but it is correct that the defense attorney at the time did not object to the...
approved the jury instructions that were given.
Right. Correct. They did not approve the jury instructions.
It's very important. What exactly did counsel say?
Your Honor, the exact statement...
This is the difference between waiver and forfeiture, and we need to know exactly what happened to know whether this is on the waiver side or the forfeiture side.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the government has conceded that this was a forfeiture and not a waiver.
I'm not asking what the government has conceded. I'm asking precisely what counsel said.
Your Honor, I don't have the quote in front of me, but they did not say that they approve of 15. The court went through the district court went through the instructions and inquired whether or not there was any objection. There was a statement that there was no objection to the instruction, which would result in plain error review.
Who proposed the instruction?
The government.
Did the defense propose any instructions on this subject?
No, Your Honor. The instructions that were provided, Your Honor, did not discuss the requisite mens rea for the conspiracy to commit murder. The government concedes that the jury instructions themselves never reference the explicit mental or the mental state, which was premeditation and malice aforethought, and that the mental state that's referenced in the conspiracy instructions is a mental state of knowingly.
Even if you're right that there was a mistake, and even if a good look at the record tells us that this is a forfeiture situation, not a waiver situation, I'm having trouble seeing how any such error affected anything in this trial. The juries know what murder is, number one. I mean, it's not some fancy regulatory violation that people would have no idea about. And the entire trial is about who is involved in this plot to kill the two individuals in question. So I'm having trouble kind of at the harmless error level.
Your Honor, and I do think that's kind of where the rubber meets the road on this issue. I do think you're correct to say that mental state was a central issue in the trial, but the issue isn't just what murder is. I think you're correct. Obviously, everybody has a common sense idea of what murder is.
You were planning and meant to kill these two people. I mean, you know, I don't see what's hard.
Well, in this case, I think what's hard is that there's a fair amount that Mr. Kyra, I think, as the court alluded to earlier, conceded to, in the sense that he acknowledged that there was that's what Mr. Mann was talking about. He acknowledged that he had exchanged these text messages.
He acknowledges he does nothing about it, even though there's this plot hatching.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
He acknowledges that he did nothing about it. He made no phone calls. He didn't alert the police. He didn't do anything.
That's correct, and I think that's why this distinction is important here, because I think a jury looking at this could say, well, he should have done something here to stop it if he was really concerned about this. But what's required, and I think what's not common sense, is this idea that when the person enters the conspiracy, they have to have the mens rea to commit the substantive offense. And Mr. Kyra's testimony throughout the trial and the defense's position throughout the trial is that he never intended for anybody to be killed.
But the jury doesn't buy it.
Yeah, the jury didn't buy that. And I'm concerned about this same problem, Mr. Jones. And I guess let me ask it a different way. Could you describe for me a situation in which the defendant agrees with other people to have two people killed and does not make that agreement with premeditation and malice aforethought, as those concepts are understood in the law?
Well, because of the way that the conspiracy instruction works, I think it's possible that the jury could look at the evidence and say, well, Mr. Kyra, he obviously knew what was going on here, and he did things that furthered that goal, in the sense that he exchanged these text messages. There's indications that he exchanged
information. The jury is told you have to find an agreement beyond a reasonable doubt to murder, right?
That's correct.
Okay. How could the jury make that finding without implicitly finding premeditation and malice aforethought?
I think that because of the limitation of the conspiracy is to knowingly and with an intent to further, where the mens rea of premeditation and malice aforethought is with to the object.
And the object is
intent
murder.
To kill. Yes. And so, and I think also, just to direct the court's attention to United States versus Harrelson, under Your Honor's logic, it would always be harmless. Essentially, the rule in Ingram would be inapplicable at
but
all.
But in Harrelson, the issue was raised.
That's correct.
As to the one
it
defendant.
Was under harmless
and
error.
And here we've got the problem of plain error review, and we need to be to reverse. We would need to be satisfied that this is an unjust result. So I'm asking you to describe for me the middle ground in which a defendant agrees with other people to have two people killed and is not having the mental state that we describe as malice aforethought.
Where the person does so or enters the agreement based on the fact, as was evidenced in this case, that they're fearful of the person that they're talking to, not to the extent of duress, but in the case of Chandra, which is cited by the government, which is actually Harrelson coming back after another conviction, the Fifth Circuit explicitly states it's possible to have essentially conspiracy to commit second-degree murder. It's your mental state at the time that you make the agreement.
No, that doesn't sound like denying premeditation or malice aforethought. It sounds like a duress, coercion, or other justification defense.
Your Honor, I
intentionally set out to kill any lawyer who makes a bad oral argument in the Seventh Circuit, but I claim coercion as a defense, that, you know, I was put out of my mind by the quality of advocacy, right? That doesn't negate my premeditation, but it might give me a defense. Probably wouldn't. By the way, I'm not contemplating this.
That's his present state of mind, so it's in this way.
I don't want to be charged with putting anybody in fear here in the courtroom.
Your Honor, I'll just close by saying that I think that the duress situation is distinguishable because of the nature of conspiracy. This was not a case where there's some moment where they say Mr. Kyra conspired. The jury was asked to make this decision based on circumstantial evidence, and essentially that the conspiracy emerged from these text messages, that he must have conspired at that point.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Holler.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mr. Kyra has raised two issues on appeal. We believe his claim of evidentiary error is squarely foreclosed by this Court's decision in Palladino, and his attacks on the jury instructions cannot meet this Court's stringent test of plain error review. On the first question, Your Honor, we do believe that this is foreclosed by Palladino. If anything, I think Palladino is to Luce what this case is to Oler. I think in both Palladino and Luce, the defendant chose not to testify, chose essentially not to have the information come in. And in both Oler and this case, the defendant did testify, and the information did come in. In Oler, it just came in through his direct testimony, so he couldn't challenge it. And in this case, it came in. It came in through his testimony, and so the evidentiary error can no longer be complained of.
What if there were only two people in the world who could testify about a critical part of the defendant's case, and the district court says, I'm not going to let – one of them is the defendant, one of them is somebody else. And the district court says, I'm not going to let the other person testify. So actually the only way that evidence on this pertinent point could come in is if the defendant waives his Fifth Amendment right. Do you think that's covered by Palladino and Luce?
I think that's directly covered by Palladino. I think Palladino says we have a choice to make. We can say that the defendant gets two bites at the apple, or we can say the defendant is put to a very hard choice.
So what about Luce? Did Palladino, in your view, extend Luce?
I don't believe that it did, Your Honor. I mean, Luce does discuss Brooks in New Jersey versus Portash on 469 U.S. 42-43, and it says, you know, a federal court's preliminary ruling on a question not reaching constitutional dimensions, you know, that's not what this is. This is a claim of evidentiary error. And if your claim is a claim of evidentiary error, I mean, suppose there were only two people in the world who could testify and one of them is, and they aren't the defendant. One is excluded and the other one can come in. The defendant is put to a hard choice. Do I want to put witness B on, even though witness B may have a whole bunch of bad stuff to say about me and may make this a really hard case, or not? And the defendant can say, you know what, I think if I put witness B on, I'm going to lose, so I'm going to accept this ruling, I'm going to appeal it, it's this dead-bang winner for me, and this is going to be reversed. You know, and it's such a dead-bang winner, I'm going to file for motion for bail pending appeal, I'm never going to have to go to jail. Obviously, it's a hard situation, but that's the remedy that this court set forth in Palladino, and I think I think the court was correct in Palladino that it's squarely controlled by Luce, but at a minimum, I think it's not contrary to Luce. It's not contrary to anything that any other court has said, and so under this court's jurisprudence, there is no basis to overrule it. I think that pretty much covers that issue, Your Honors. I don't think that this court can overcome Palladino. For the reasons we've cited, we don't think there was evidentiary error anyway, but even if there was, the court said, in fact, squarely said in Palladino, there was evidentiary error here. It still said it's not reversible because of Palladino. Your Honor, on the jury instruction question, we did set out on page 23 in note 5 an excerpt, and our explanation under Natal as to why we believed forfeiture applied here, although it's ultimately this court's decision as to what its standard of review is. But in terms of what the actual...
We have a long problem in the Seventh Circuit of some panels referring to this as waiver and some as forfeiture. I mean, one of these days we're probably going to have to get it straightened out. Do you think this is a good case?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a good case because I don't think it makes a difference in this particular case. And
well, that suggests it's not a good case.
That would suggest it's a bad case.
What would be a good case is a case where the distinction makes a difference.
And certainly, I cannot disagree with Your Honor that this is an area of the law where the court seems to be weaving back and forth, and it would certainly help the government, defendants, and everyone to know.
Drunken sailor comes to mind.
Much as Mr. Heller enjoys appearing before this court in bank.
Yes, if you would like to take that in a case not from, well, this is from the Northern District of Illinois where I'm here on a recusal, but in any event. For the record, the area where this is, if the court does want to look at it, is between pages 788 and 792. And the government states, that's Mr. Diamantados, Judge, for the record, 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 are not objected to. And Mr. Wagner, defense counsel, stands up and says, we do have an objection to 15, Judge. And then later on, they go through 18 again, and the court says, is 18 agreed? That's on page 790. And Mr. Diamantados, again, government counsel, says, is agreed. So, this is about as close to that line as you can get. Under Natal, it seems to me he hasn't directly stood up and said, I agree to 18, but he said, I don't agree to 15, which sure seems to imply he agrees to 18. Now, that all said...
But then he doesn't pipe up after the government says something about 18.
Yeah, he never... the government... Yeah. The defendant is standing there. Defense counsel is standing there. And before this, of course, as we've also described in the record, that Judge Hibbler asked the parties to go and see what they can agree on. And essentially, he has the government report back. Here's what we agreed on. We agreed on this. We agreed on this. Oh, we didn't agree on this. Defense counsel steps in. So I don't know how the court in any way, shape, or form could have thought that there was any objection to Instruction 18 here.
So it does seem a little odd if the standard of review depends upon whether the district judge says to the defense counsel, and do you agree or not.
It seems to me it's a fairly that the distinction the court has drawn is
or a, are you asleep? I guess
is a relatively meaningless one.
Right. Although one of our more recent decisions encourages district judges to put the defendants and the prosecutors to their choice about saying agree or not, and I have this vision of a questionnaire being handed out with each jury instruction and then three possible boxes: agree, disagree, have not read.
I don't think there's any real benefit to turning jury instruction conferences into Rule 11 plea colloquies. I don't. But that said, in this particular case, and ultimately, what this court has been went through with my opposing counsel is, did it affect the substantial rights in this particular case? And the answer is, it did not. I mean, the reason that we let parties come together and decide what the jury instructions are going to be is so that the parties can come together and decide what is the issue in this case. Now, if the defendant had wanted to try to defend this case on this dancing on a pin idea that's sort of explored in Chagra of maybe I intended to agree to commit murder, but it was second-degree murder and not first-degree murder, I suppose if he had stood up and said, that's my defense, and just like in Harrelson, I want to present this instruction. First of all, the government is not going to, stand there and object to this instruction, especially in light of Harrelson, where they did and got reversed. And I don't think the district court is going to disagree with that either. If we did, I would have a much, much harder case. But the parties are allowed to decide what the issues are in the case. And as defense counsel stated on page 55 of closing, the issue in this case is not that element of what's the definition of the underlying offense, but did the defendant, intend to join the conspiracy, and did he intend to further it and make it succeed? And so the more the parties want to focus on those elements, the more helpful it is to the jury and the less helpful it is to put in a whole bunch of stuff that isn't really an issue between the parties. So the case was very focused on, did he join the conspiracy? Did he intend to further it? And if the jury believed Mr. Mann, if the jury believed Mr. Ruiz, and if the jury took that inference from the text messages, they could find that. But the other underlying questions simply are not there. And that means that considering the stringent standard of review, which is at least plain error, obviously if it's waiver, I should just sit down now, but if it's forfeiture and if it's plain error, it did not affect his substantial rights. because the issue wasn't the underlying substantive crime. There was no dispute about what the underlying substantive crime was. It was a premeditated effort to murder a drug enforcement agent and assistant United States attorney. And there was no doubt that Mr. Mann and Mr. Ruiz were planning to do that. They intended to do that at the time. The question is whether Mr. Kira directed them to do that, solicited them to do that, wanted them to do that, or whether this was all Mr. Mann's idea and Mr. Kira was out on the sideline with no real involvement other than having heard about it.
How would the murders have benefited Mr. Mann?
Well, the murders would have benefited Mr. Mann, I believe, because only financially.
Other than being paid by Mr. Kira.
They would not have. They would have benefited him financially, and that's why he wanted to be a part of it. He was going to get depending on the various demands that went back and forth, he was either going to get money or he was going to get drugs, or Mr. Kira's underlying case was from him stealing chemical formulas and drugs from Northwestern, and he was going to get essentially a formula that he could use to create drugs from more common household items. So you're
saying that Mr. Kira didn't have a theory about why Mr. Mann might have cooked this up all by himself?
Well, Mr. Kira's theory, I think, was that Mr. Mann was crazy. I mean, that was basically his argument, is he kind of went to – I mean, you know, I think the defense theory essentially was I mentioned my problems to Mr. Mann, and Mr. Mann was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to help you out, and here's how I'm going to help you out. I'm going to go kill the prosecutor and the agent. I'm going to go kill – you know, what's the – so tell me the name of the prosecutor. Oh, it's Shoshana Gillers. Oh, tell me the name of the DEA agent. Oh, it's – Pat Bagley. And he never thought, oh, by telling this crazy man this information, it's going to go that way. Now, that's contrary, I believe, to the bulk of the evidence. And I don't want to really even endorse that theory because it's the jury rejected it. And we don't believe it's true. The jury believed that Mr. Kira went and solicited Mr. Mann, who he knew had drug connections. And Mr. Mann, in turn, solicited somebody he knew who could murder people. Mm-hmm. And they then plotted and negotiated at great length to try to get this done. In any event, the jury made those findings. There was no evidentiary error. Any evidentiary error was waived by Palladino. And the jury instructions, again, there was no plain error. Mm-hmm. The court has no further questions. We would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.